Good morning. Welcome to this meeting of the Institute's Iraq Working Group on who will govern Iraq next. And we should all start from the same database. I think I should point out that the Election Commission in Iraq very cooperatively issued results this morning. This afternoon, Iraq time, I guess, that have the United Iraqi Alliance at 128 seats, the Kurdistan Alliance at 53, Iraqi Accord Front 44, Iraqi Nationalist 25, Iraqi Front for National Dialogue 11, and other parties 14. This is according to the BBC. I think we all know how important these elections have already been, and what we'll look forward to is this discussion today of what their implications are for the future government in Iraq. Seems to me there is a great deal to discuss, and we've got four very good people to discuss the question, at least initially, and then quite a few well-informed people here as well. Dr. Karim al-Moussaoui is the representative of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They won, more or less. Anna Shalal is many things, but we have him listed as Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives in his capacity speaking this morning. Quill Lawrence, who's reports for PRI, something we all listen to quite a bit. And Jonathan Morrow, who many of you know as a program officer here at the Institute, but more importantly, somebody who's spent a great deal of time on the ground in Baghdad trying to be helpful in making the constitutional process as open as possible. And as a result, he's become the author of a number of works on how the constitutional process was not very open. Those are available to you. We're going to start with Dr. al-Moussaoui, go to Anna Shalal, then Quill Lawrence, then Jonathan Morrow. Dr. al-Moussaoui. I should mention that we have to end at 11:20 rather than 11:30 because of other events here, so we're going to shorten it just a bit.
Good morning. First, I would like to thank the USIP and in particular Dr. Sarwar and Mr. Hughes for inviting me to be a part of this event. I will try to go through these papers and, of course, through your questions to answer the questions, who will govern Iraq next. Through the course of last year, three historic elections took place in Iraq. They represented challenges and as well as successes in the context of the future of Iraq. The first election took place on January 15, 2005, which represented the true beginning of legitimacy of political process in Iraq and for the drafting of the constitution. The second was the referendum on a permanent constitution, which took place on October 15, 2005. The third was the elections of permanent Council of Representatives, which took place on December 15, 2005. The December election occurred in the context of the approval of a permanent constitution and the establishment of a parliament and 4 years constitutional government. Despite the obstacles that are facing our experience today, the security side in particular, we believe that there was real progress in Iraq in terms of rebuilding our country and in the attainment of freedom that the Iraqis finally have after decades of tyranny. However, there are still challenges on the long way of democracy. Among the most important of these challenges is the Iraqis' understanding of the new status of country and the end of one-man rule and dictatorship. A second challenge is the evolution of the Iraqis' understanding of the new political process, including the new democratic standards and respect for the diversity of the Iraqi people, reflecting the will of the Iraqi people when they headed purposefully to the three polls last year. This resulted in the coalition forming of a number of basic groups topped by the United Iraqi Alliance, the UIA. The uncertified preliminary accounts that were announced today by the Independent Electoral Commission in Iraq, IECI, showed that United Iraqi Alliance secured 128 seats. That's represented 46.5%. The Kurdistan Coalition, 53 seats, 19.3%. National Accordance Front, 45.16%. Iraqi National List, 25 seats, 9%. The National Dialogue List, 11 seats, 4%. And the Kurdistan Islamic Union, 5 seats, 1.8%. Reconciliation and Liberation List, 3 seats, 1.1%. Risaliyun, they are originally Sadrists, 2 seats, and 1 seat for Ar-Rafidain List, the Assyrians, Iraqi National List, the Mithal Alusi, and Turkmen Front, Yazidis Movement. The IECI member Hussein Hindawi said that there were cancellation of 227 ballot boxes from 31,500 boxes all over Iraq. Nonetheless, IECI confirmed that there were no major violations and that there was no need for re-elections or total cancellation. The UN observers in Iraq also confirmed that fairness and legitimacy of these elections, which faced objections from the losers who put forth accusation of fraud and demanded the nullification of the results or the holding of new elections, at least in certain places. What do the Iraqis wait for after the announcement of the final results? Sorry about that. Of the election. There are many aspects that need to be pointed which related to the political, religious, and ethnic issues. First, the formation of the participation government led by United Iraqi Alliance as the largest bloc in the Parliament Council is the best outcome despite the negative elements and political obstacles that might accompany such government. UIA and CIRI believe that such a government eliminates some possible political and social congestions, which might add to the current security crisis from which the country is currently suffering. This is what the United Iraqi Alliance called for before the election, and this is also always part of its election agenda. The United Iraqi Alliance understands very clearly that the Iraqi political body cannot and should not marginalize any of the Iraqi constituents. We have to honor this fact with consideration to the results of the December 15th elections. If this fact is ignored, it will create a large gap hindering the political process. Honoring these election facts shall guarantee the rights of the votes rather than the demands of the political elites. Second, the coming government should be a government focused on sustainable development and reconstruction, a government to revive economy and infrastructure, guarantee security, and provide the people with work opportunities and basic services. For many years, the Iraqis have suffered from the lack of the basic needs. Without a new government guaranteeing these things, we cannot achieve a smooth transfer to the next phase. Such a government also would be able to convince the world community to get the needed assistance and support our development process. Most Iraqis admit that there is a terror crisis requiring an effective remedy. One of the basic duties of the coming government should be concentrating on fighting terrorism in all aspects. This requires fortifying the Iraqi forces to confront terrorism. Additionally, it should open up to the widest social class, which believe in the political process rather than others. Terrorists are trying to make Iraq a stage for the failure of democracy and conflict of the international community. As Osama bin Laden made clear yesterday by saying that Iraq is becoming an attraction area for the jihadists. This is why the Iraqis are seeking to isolate these factions and eliminate them to facilitate constructing a national unity and coalition based on the people's support. Some media claims that Sunnis are the root of the crisis in the country. But the fact of the Sunnis' actual participation in the election and constitutional process clearly indicates that the media oversimplifies the situation with their inaccurate analysis. Yes, the Sunnis have their political demands, but all Iraqis have to face the fact that there is a serious terror crisis in the country. The Sunnis' engagement in the national political process will further isolate the terrorists in the western section of the country. To completely eliminate terrorism and to avoid any attempt to drown the country into internal conflict, all political sides should work together under the Constitution. Also, as the Iraqi president, Talabani, pointed out, some Iraqi politicians work with us in the morning and with the terrorists in the evening. Also, the American ambassador in Iraq, Zalman Khalilzad, said these leaders cannot have a foot in the insurgency and a foot in the government. They cannot hide behind the slogan of resistance or tolerate a violent movement against the legitimate government. These dead-enders are trying to buy time to impose their terms by threatening the country in order to destabilize the process of democratization in Iraq. Regarding the elimination of terrorism in the country, the full cooperation between the coalition forces and the Iraqi forces to enable them to have full control on the security issue is of utmost importance. This is in accordance with the call of President Bush to pull the coalition forces from inside the Iraqi cities and let the Iraqi forces take their place instead when they are ready for the job. There are many places in Iraq today that could be protected by Iraqi forces. It is also very important to activate the terrorism law as drafted by the National Assembly last year to save the lives of Iraqis and Americans from violations that are caused by terrorists. Third, Iraqis won't be able to establish their new country on the principles of justice, equality, human rights, and freedom as defined in the permanent constitution, without the participation of all Iraqi components. This is a fact acknowledged by all Iraqis, no exception. This is why the UIA, being the largest coalition in the new parliament, formed special committees that encompass all political factors who won the elections in order to form the participation government, which would be able to run the country with the respect of maintaining equilibrium through the elections outcomes. According to the perception, we believe that the main Iraqi components, the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds, are all together will govern Iraq through the participation government. This can only be done if the Sunnis succeed in understanding the new reality in Iraq, become a part of real presence, actively participate in the government, and not a hindrance or opposition. Fourth, the federalism that was enacted by the Constitution to be the new administrative system of new Iraq is the most suitable for the diversity of the Iraqi people. And due to its successful implementation in different cultural contexts throughout the world, the federal experience of the Kurdistan region is also believed to be good for guaranteeing the security and the economic life of the individuals. The federal system within specified laws in accordance with the Constitution will guarantee everyone's equality and eliminate any fears that any party or community might have from others. Federalism would be a privilege for all Iraqis without any exception. Fifth, still we have time, right? The encouragement of sectarian or ethnical favoritism, as it has been during the past dictatorship regime, heavily contributed to what the Iraqi people have been suffering from as a whole by ethnic cleansing, mass murder, and isolation. This represents one of the dangers surrounding the political process and the future of the country. This is why the Iraqis have to abandon confessionalism and eliminate it throughout all government levels and throughout the Parliament Council by supporting the qualified and efficient Iraqis as well to address the more than 54 articles that still need to be classified as laws through the legislative process and then through a referendum as outlined in the Constitution. However, it is important to recognize that the position of UIA is that no serious changes can be made to the Constitution that was ratified by 70% of the Iraqis only by the Parliament Council and through its legal conducts. We believe that the current symbolic presidential council, which represents the three main components in Iraq, is enough at this time for showing the moral aspects and the unity of Iraq, also flourishing democracy in the country is the only way to weakening the sectarian and ethnical polarization. Six, and finally, I'm watching. Opening an active and blunt dialogue with the international community and with the regional countries concerning Iraq's requirements would help Iraqis improve their security and economic situation, rather than the current focus of some of the regional states on maintaining stability as they defined it. The Iraqi neighbors can do a great deal for Iraq and the foremost issue is to secure the mutual borders with Iraq and to prevent infiltration by terrorists who are still penetrating Iraq's border and drying out the monetary resources which undoubtedly assist in strengthening security and stability in Iraq. The fact that the terrorists are trying to deprive the country and its people from freedom and their attempt to establish a base for terrorism makes it a must for the international community to extend their support to the Iraqi people to build its infrastructure and economy. The next elected government shall be the one responsible for finding a common grounds with the coalition upon making sure that the Iraqi forces are well prepared to handle their duties. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Al-Moussaoui. Anas Shalal, Dr. Moussaoui suggests that the broad coalition, national unity government with federalism based on the Constitution as approved is the solution. Do you see it that way?
I think it's hard to speak about these elections without really speaking a little bit about the background in which these elections are taking place. Contrary to repeated predictions that the December 15 parliamentary elections in Iraq, that they will end the insurgency, they in fact did nothing to drain support from the insurgency. Since the elections, the insurgency has not subsided, and in fact has increased in the past several weeks with more fatalities inflicted on civilians and military personnel. In the past month alone, since the latest elections, over 800 Iraqi civilians have been killed, along with over 75 U.S. soldiers. According to the Pentagon figures, around 2,000 to 3,000 insurgents have been killed in the same period. There was a report that came out that said that there were about 15 to 20,000 insurgents active in Iraq. Since that report, the Pentagon have indicated that they have been killing approximately 2,000 to 3,000 or capturing insurgents per month. This would mean that in the past 5 months, most of the insurgents would have been killed or captured. Yet with every passing day, the insurgency has become more sophisticated and potent, belying the claim that the insurgency is a handful of foreign fighters. Iraqis have been told that these elections are a major milestone that will ease the insurgency, create a better Iraq. In fact, Iraqis see these elections as a way for them to take matters in their own hands and rid Iraq of foreign fighters, Arabs, Americans, and other foreign nationalities. Yet the elections have done little but confirm the worst fears of many Iraqis, namely creating an Iraq that is dominated more and more by religious extremists closely aligned with Iran's religious elites. Furthermore, Iraqis are asking themselves, are they better off today than they were 3 years ago? Although Iraqis remain forever grateful for the removal of Saddam Hussein and his cadre of criminal thugs, they are baffled at how chaotic their life has become and the lack of basic human needs. Electricity is still at an all-time low, with spotty service at best in many cities, including Baghdad. Clean water is available to less than 30% of the population, according to a report from Baghdad University. The gas lines stretch for miles, and people have to wait at night in their cars to be able to be first in line. A cousin of mine relays a story of having to sleep in his car with a machine gun at his side to get gas for the family generator, only to go home to siphon it out of the gas tank because containers are prohibited. It is hard to imagine such conditions when Iraq sits on the second largest proven reserve oil in the world. This week, Human Rights Watch released its report for 2005. According to the report, the human rights situation in Iraq has deteriorated significantly last year. They cite specifically the rise in daily insurgent attacks, kidnappings, abuse and torture, and a very high number of civilian casualties at the hands of Iraqi and U.S.-led forces. The report further goes on to state that efforts to boost economic reconstruction, rebuilding of Iraq's infrastructure, continue to be hampered by general instability in the country and the level of violence caused by the insurgency and the counterinsurgency attacks. Furthermore, there's an absence of basic precautions by U.S. military to protect civilians. Torture at Abu Ghraib and other Iraqi prisons continues. There are doubts about the Iraqi High Tribunal trying Saddam Hussein and others from his regime to hold a fair trial. Other agencies like USAID have reported a country that is mired in lawlessness, amounting to a social breakdown which criminals have almost free rein. These conditions that I just mentioned have created an environment that is ideal for those seeking to polarize Iraq and create further division among the many sectarian and religious communities. I lay out some of these facts because they are important to understand the insurgency and the proverbial oxygen that it craves and the need to deal with its root causes, as well as the impact of the elections. With the exception of a handful of people living in the green zone and those who are directly associated with the current government, most Iraqis are far less concerned about the elections and far more concerned about their day-to-day living. Many experts agree that the elections can have a significant impact on allowing those disenfranchised factions to join in the governance of Iraq. These elections in particular can have a major impact on the legitimacy of the new Iraqi government. Yet any elections exercised under an occupation cannot and will not be perceived as legitimate or fair. Several Iraqi groups have expressed outrage at the way the elections were conducted. The abysmal security conditions in the Sunni areas made it impossible for many to cast their votes. If, in fact, the Sunnis make up the heart of the insurgency, then such conditions can only further inflame and anger and create more mistrust. The results of the elections, as was mentioned, were predictably dire for many Iraqis, with the religious Shiite-dominated ticket receiving the lion's share of the votes, followed by the Kurdish Alliance and then the Alawi List. On the other hand, the Sunni parties did not vote very well, with 25 for the Iraqi Front, 11 seats for the National Dialogue Group. In some areas, as few as 2% were able to cast their vote in the Anbar region, for example. In the Nainoa province, which includes the third largest city, which is Mosul, only 17% of the voters were able to participate in the election. These results place a larger burden on Iraqi civil society to emerge as a significant player, providing the foundation for moving forward. Building a civil society based on democracy and a rule of law is essential for providing an Iraq that is representative of its various ethnic and religious minorities. When the U.S. entered Iraq, there was a great deal of hope for building a strong and vibrant civil society. Yet 3 years later, the conditions for such building blocks have been stalled due to lack of funding and lack of security. Unlike Western NGOs, Iraqi organizations have been used to working close alignment with government. In order for it to grow, Iraqi civil society must learn to develop outside the shadow of government, which leaves much to be and to allow for a deeper participation. The present government leaves much to be desired and thus is forcing the proliferation of Iraqi civil society that will have to take matters in its own hands and become the key to building the bridges that will transform Iraqi society into one that respects laws and human rights for all. And I'll wait till afterwards to take some questions. I cut it a little short just to allow for more dialogue.
Thank you, Anas. Thank you. You paint a grim picture, but one in which civil society emerges is to rescue Iraq. Quill, what are the odds of that?
I like to think that being a journalist excuses me from making any conclusions whatsoever. And I thought that I would I was in Iraq for all three of the elections or polls that were held last year, the parliamentary elections in the first ones in I observed from Kirkuk in the north, the referendum in October I was in Mosul, and for this previous election I was in Fallujah. It might be needless to say that in those last two I was embedded with U.S. troops, which unfortunately is the only way I find acceptable to go to those places these days for a foreigner. I don't know about the figures in terms of turnout. In Fallujah on election day, December 15th, I saw a lot of people voting, and there seemed to be a mood, perhaps because of the endorsement of Sheikh Hamza, who had been killed only a couple of weeks before the election, one of the most important, if not the most important, Sunni religious leader in Fallujah, had endorsed these elections and told people to go out. And I got the sense that a lot of people were taking the spirit of his endorsement, and perhaps motivated by the by his assassination, they were turning out in what I could not scientifically say, but what seemed like pretty good numbers. A lot of people were telling me that they thought that it had been a mistake to sit out of the process, which I know is essentially what the United States had been waiting to hear. That the Sunnis were interested in participating. However, there were really varied. Many people were going out there to vote, saying that they were voting to get the U.S. out, to get the U.S. out now. There were many people who said that they were going out there because they were encouraged by the they call them resistance forces. Some people call them terrorists. There's also gunmen would be a neutral word, I suppose. They were saying that these people, that these resistance forces were telling them to go out and vote so that they could show what a fraudulent process this democracy was going to be, and this was going to drive more people into the resistance. There's a bit of a problem in Fallujah with politicians. It's a problem for politicians, I should say, there, because they have several audiences at all times. One of them might be me and, I guess, the world press. At the same time, they have to live there. So it's sometimes hard to judge what is rhetoric. But there was a real variance there. Other people said that they thought that these elections weren't necessarily going to stop the armed resistance, as they called it, but that this would begin a two-pronged approach where they could be fighting in the parliament and still fighting in Al-Anbar province. Looking at the results, which were essentially what was expected a few weeks ago but have just been finalized an hour or two ago, it's not that much different from the previous equation. And one question that a lot of people were asking was whether there would be any difference. You still have what will essentially be a power-sharing arrangement between the Kurds and the United Shiite bloc. They'll probably have to shave a few votes off from somewhere else in order to get the two-thirds majority they need to select a president. One big difference, I think, is that in the interim government, you had the members of the coalition and some members of the Iraqi interim government constantly trying to persuade Sunnis to come in to the government and participate, and they did get some people in there. But the people who are going to be there now are really representatives of their constituencies. That's what I saw on the ground in Mosul and in Fallujah, Saqlawiya. These are people who they really have elected. Now, that's a big plus. It means that they're seeing their own people in the parliament now, but it also brings a risk because if they are disillusioned with the process, they're really disillusioned this time. It's not saying that, those people who were appointed by the Americans are not our people and therefore we're not in the government. This is their people this time, and if they don't get what they see as their share of representation in the government, then the disillusion with this process will be very real. Now, that brings us to another very important point, which is one's vision of one's share of the government. There's an adjustment going on, and I'm not sure how smoothly, of expectations. One diplomat in Baghdad said this could be a learning experience for the Sunni Arab constituencies, that they're finding out just what their size is in Iraqi society. But I'm sure you've all heard the numbers people quoted. It seems that at one time or another, most everyone in Iraq thinks that they represent 60% of the population. From the get-go, people in Anbar province were upset that only 9 seats were going to Anbar. In their minds, I think in the minds of Fallujans, one of the voters told me that this is the most famous city in the world, Fallujah. And they were not accepting the idea that they only got those seats. So even if they got every seat from that province, it wasn't going to be enough from the start. Starting the day, not even the day after, but the day of or the day before the election, there was what I hope was just jockeying and sort of opening brinksmanship, talking about how this wasn't enough, this wasn't acceptable. And then what I think were relatively minor allegations of fraud fed into that, and unfortunately, I think this long delay also feeds into that. This perception that things were rigged against them from the beginning, which is something that got the Sunnis and some of the secular parties out. I think what Mr. Moussaoui referred to as the losers out protesting almost immediately, preemptively protesting. And again, we have to wait and see how much of this was preemptive bargaining for the next, in what we'll see will be a 2-month process probably of bargaining over the makeup of the new government, and how much was legitimate outrage and suspicion of the process. And again, the problem is that the rhetoric here can be very violent. The Sunni candidates are in the position of having to realize that they They think they were in a bad spot for the last year, being totally cut out of the government. One diplomat was saying that they have a choice now whether they want to be talking in the parliament this year or just talking to Al Jazeera like they were last year. They're going to have to make that choice, but at the same time, they have to go home, I assume, to Fallujah. And you have to, if they don't bring home the bacon, obviously not the bacon, if they don't bring home something that is going to satisfy people in Fallujah, then I really don't think they should probably go there. If you can see someone like Sheikh Hamza being assassinated in Fallujah, it shows that no one is safe from the violence. They need to bring home something, perhaps the head of the interim interior minister, to Fallujah in order to satisfy the people there. And I don't know if they're going to get that. There were a lot of other things on people's minds in Anbar this trip, and it was similar in Mosul when I was there in October. Again, I should stress, I'm giving you just a tiny... I see a very tiny portion of this because it's so difficult to get around for Westerners in Iraq right now. So I guess take all of my remarks with that caveat. But people I was talking to were very upset about the Jadriya prison, these prisons where, in their opinion, just Sunnis were being held and were being tortured, and these allegations of torture do seem to have some substance. People in Al Anbar and Nineveh provinces really felt under siege, not only because, for example, in the constitution they felt they were being railroaded. They talked about federalism as just a way for the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south to cut up the country. They also had the trial going on at the same time. The Saddam Hussein trial was going on at the same time as the referendum, and then continuing in this election. And I think it contributes to this mentality, this siege mentality many Sunnis are feeling at the moment. In Fallujah, people were talking about the trial and saying, why is there a trial going on for these 148 Shiites killed in Dujail when there were many more people than that killed in Fallujah this week by foreign forces and by Iraqi forces? Their math is obviously... distorted, but they do have a... this is a point that resonates there, is that there's... they feel as though there's no one speaking for their cases. I mean, there were many, of course, many people in Al Anbar province who were killed, disappeared, tortured by Saddam's regime, and they just don't see that being represented. That's a problem with the trial process at the moment. I was wondering why there were no Sunni cases being brought on the docket, and I was offered one response, was that it was very hard to get Sunnis to come forward to testify. But in any case, it just lets you know this feeling of siege that many Sunnis feel. Furthermore, the Iraqi forces in their towns are, many people told me they consider them just as foreign as the Americans. Almost every member of the new Iraqi army I met in Mosul and in Fallujah and in Saqlawiya were either Shiite Arab or Kurd. And one fellow at one polling station even told me that for him and the people in Fallujah, he said it was a relief to know that one of their relatives has been taken into custody by the Americans and not the Iraqi army. So this is another feeling of division there, and it's something that if the Iraqi army really is going to be a force for security that people at least in Anbar will accept, it needs to be better integrated there. And I guess there is some progress being seen that many people are lining up to be new recruits. I was going to talk a little bit about the Kurdish area because we don't have someone representing that here, but maybe I'll save that for questions because I'm not sure. That's a better idea. Whether people are going to accept this government is really the big question. This haggling can go on forever. The government can be perfectly apportioned mathematically. It can have incredibly bright, incredibly capable people there. And as some of the panelists have suggested, if they don't address basic issues like security and basic issues like electricity, and the outrageous fact that Iraqis have to stand in line for a day to get gasoline for their cars, then it really won't matter very much. I think this delay has been a handicap. I think that waiting several weeks before even announcing the results that will begin the endless bargaining process we're about to witness is something that lets these seeds of mistrust and suspicion grow, but here we are. As I said, I'm hoping that the cries foul saying that there was fraud were just the beginning of a bargaining position, but if you say it long enough, it's something that maybe convinces the population and makes it much harder for them to accept. I guess my main concern at the moment is that what is currently an insurgency, which uses what many, I guess, would call terrorist tactics, is going to turn into an escalating civil war, which many people say is already underway, that many of these attacks are sectarian. When a bomb blows up next to the Sheraton Hotel and it happens to be videoed, then everyone sees it and says, oh, there was a bomb in Baghdad today. When a journalist is kidnapped, this makes big news. But the dozens and dozens of kidnappings daily in Baghdad alone, the several dozen murders in Baghdad, according to just a call to the morgue, that many of which appear to be sectarian, I think is the major concern, whether this insurgency will turn to a civil war. A friend of mine who lives in a northern, predominantly Sunni Arab suburb of Baghdad told me that the Ministry of the Interior, the police, were coming to his neighborhood, and that his neighborhood essentially considered them to be a foreign occupying force, said that they were coming to get people, and that he'd organized what was essentially a neighborhood watch committee that had then turned the police away, sent them running. He gave me a wild casualty figure. And then he said that the police came back with American troops. This was just an anecdote, but it's something that really scares me because it seems to be the beginning of the forming of camps and the sort of thing that could start with a low-intensity civil war and then perhaps escalate. And again, what we've been hearing so far, even before these results, saying that there will be no changes to the Constitution and saying it loud. Again, I don't know how much of this is bargaining. The Sunni Arabs, some of them had agreed to support the Constitution only in a last-minute deal brokered by Zalmay Khalilzad, which guaranteed them the right to amend this Constitution. Coming out and saying there will be no amendments is inflammatory. Maybe it's just bargaining. Denying an American selection for head of the armed forces who is Sunni Arab and insisting to be replaced with a Shia Arab is inflammatory, and as I said, I hope that this is a bargaining process that will be smoothed out over the next couple of months, and I look forward to taking your questions.
Thank you very much, Quill. You emphasize the importance of popular acceptance, the difficulties of obtaining it, siege mentality, need for adjustment of expectations. Jonathan, you've watched this process very carefully over the last year and a half, I guess it is. Where are we?
Thanks, Dan. Unlike Quill, I'm not a journalist. I'm a lawyer, and I'm giving the concluding address this morning, so maybe I'm forced to give some conclusions, which I'll try to do at least tentatively. When faced with the questions that this panel now confronts, who will govern Iraq next? You've heard what Dr. Moussaoui has said, and I'm certainly in no position to disagree. A few days ago, after reading the memoirs of Ambassador Bremer, I realised how difficult it has become to think about Iraq in the future tense at all. With all these memoirs and histories piling up here in the US, Iraq is looking like something that has happened rather than something that will happen. In fact, I understand that in a couple of months' time, Peter Galbraith will be publishing his own account, cheerfully entitled The End of Iraq. It remains to be seen whether this book really will spell the end of Iraq or whether it is Ambassador Galbraith trying, as usual, to have the last word. Of course, it won't be the last word because Iraq does have a future and it will be governed. It will have a government. But in asking who will govern Iraq next, it's also worth asking what is Iraq? As to who will govern, my response, which I think is supported by Dr. Moussaoui's statements and the observations of the panel today, is that it'll be more or less the same people. the same people will govern Iraq as have governed it since at least 2003. The major change that this election offers, of course, is an elected Sunni Arab leadership, but it is still generally true, as was pointed out in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, the really powerful figures in Iraq remain those who sat on the governing council back in the days of Mr. Bremer and the CPA. The reason for this is that Iraq is not some clear national playing field in which the electoral winner takes all. It's a collection of regions and local power bases, composed in large part but not exclusively on ethnic and sectarian lines. After this election, this fact should be beyond dispute. If anything, these election results show an even more sectarian Iraq, with nationalist figures like Mr. Alawi with a reduced vote, with Shia independents like Ahmed Chalabi, Salam al-Kafaji and Ali al-Dabakh with no seats at all. I understand it may be the case that there are no so-called compensatory seats allocated by the Electoral Commission, that is, there were no small parties which reached the required national threshold. It's because Iraq is so regionalised that some of our obsessions with national electoral politics may be misplaced. For instance, there is the question whether the United Iraqi Alliance, the so-called Shia Alliance, will need, as well as the Kurds, the Sunnis to achieve the necessary two-thirds or 184 seats to form a government. As Quill has pointed out, the results of the last few hours suggest that the two major parties, the Shia and Kurdish parties, will need additional votes to make that two-thirds majority. These questions are important. They also have extremely important psychological dimensions. I'm sure that even in Dr. Musawi's party there are people who would prefer to govern without any Sunni Arab ministers. However, those people are wrong and they are outliers. Regardless of how many votes the Shia alliance might have, there would always need to be some kind of national unity government. There'll always need to be a Shia, a Sunni and a Kurd in the presidency council. There'll always need to be some Sunnis in the cabinet. This is the point. Everyone knows that the real leverage of Sunni Arabs for inclusion in the government will never be a result of a one-third or 92-seat blocking vote. It comes from the core reality of Iraq's regionalised political life, which is the need to include Sunnis because they are a large minority with a special political claim to inclusion, not to mention, of course, the fact of the insurgency, which is surely fuelled at least in part by political exclusion, and everybody knows this. I think it's well understood in Iraq that it is essential that there be a Sunni member of the Presidency Council who presumably won't agree to join the council until a minimum of cabinet positions have been allocated to Sunni Arabs. What else? The Prime Minister will certainly be a representative of the UIA, as is the case now. There is clearly some competition within the UIA for this position. My only comment is that the choice of Mr. Jafari as Prime Minister would be entirely consistent with the trajectory so far of Shia and Kurdish politics. There is no interest in the end in installing in Baghdad a government that is any stronger than the current one. This then raises the question of what Iraq is. My starting point on this question is that the constitution negotiated over summer is actually an incredibly accurate reflection of Iraqi aspirations. Iraqis wanted a weak federal government and they got it. That is to say, Iraqis are not enthusiastic about the idea of Iraq and they don't even feel particularly Iraqi. So, for instance, where the constitution defines a federal government which does not have an exclusive taxation power, or where it hands management of petroleum to the regional governments, it was not an error or an oversight. It was the will of the elected leaders of the Iraqi people. As Dan pointed out, I'm very critical of the fact that not enough Iraqi people were involved in the drafting of the constitution. This, of course, had immediate implications for the insurgency, and it may yet have implications for the legitimacy of the constitutional document and the durability of constitutional institutions. But my point is that even if the process had been more inclusive, I doubt whether the constitutional text would have changed much. Iraq would still have been a loose federation or confederation. It would still have had a large role for Islamic law. The Bill of Rights would have been little better and little worse. The fact is that Iraq has had no significant proponents of a centralised government. I would include in this statement the Sunni Arab leadership, whose attachment to a centralised form of government was sentimental and rejectionist and not practical. This then leads to the question of the elected, newly elected Sunni leadership. The fact that there will soon be elected Sunni leaders in the parliament will not necessarily change the composition of the government that much. Already in the current Jafari government, there are 8 Sunni Arab ministers, or 21% of the total. This total is unlikely to change a great deal. The real question then is what these newly elected Sunni leaders will stand for. This is the question that I think Quill framed. You know, how will Sunni leaders see their share of the pie, the national good? If I can talk in very broad generalisations, the Iraqi Sunni leadership, which so far has been entirely unelected, has stood for Iraqi nationalism, sometimes Arab nationalism, coupled with demands that Iraq be a centralized state. This was certainly the position of the Sunni negotiators on the constitution. And this is important. Whether moderate or radical, the core Sunni Arab demands have never been simply to obtain a certain number of seats in parliament or a certain number of cabinet posts. Their stated goal has been to rebuild the Iraqi state as a centralized body. In a sense, then, their core demands are not political, but specifically structural or constitutional, which, apart from anything else, is why the solution to the problem of radical Sunni politics, namely the insurgency, as Mr. Shalal has pointed out, will need structural solutions, not political ones. Does this mean that Shia and Kurdish parties will need to make concessions to the Sunni centrist demands? Probably not. At this stage, I think it would be a fantasy to imagine that the dismantling of Iraq's federal architecture could actually happen. We've heard Mr. Abdulaziz al-Hakim, of course, rule out any significant change to the constitution. To answer Quill's question, I don't think this is a bargaining position. I think it's more likely a statement of fact, or at least a statement of a strongly held Skiri position, which Mr. Hakim has been articulating for some time, if not in front of a microphone. We've heard President Talabani echo those sentiments. Even if the Kurdish and Shia parties suddenly change their minds, which they won't, it would be too late to reverse the centrifugal forces at work in Iraq. So I think I am inclined to agree with Dr. Moussaoui that the Sunni Arab leadership needs to understand the so-called new reality. It is far more important and more possible for these newly elected Sunni leaders to accept the broad terms of this constitution and strategize within it. Because for all its flaws, this constitution does not rob Sunni Arabs of anything. Federalism is not code for partition. It is a serious form of government that can be neutral as between the entities in the federation. Provisions of the constitution that have attracted most Sunni Arab criticism, such as the oil provision, actually contain guarantees that Sunni Arabs will share in Iraq's wealth. Strange though it is to say, there is, so far as I can tell, a universal acceptance in Iraq of the principle that all Iraqis should share in the oil. This provision in the constitutional negotiations in Baghdad over the summer attracted zero controversy. That provision was taken for granted, agreed by all. Somewhat ironically, then, it may well turn out to be that that group which so strongly opposed the constitution at the referendum, the Sunni Arabs, will in the end have the greatest interest in seeing the constitution, this constitution, enforced. And in fact, there are signs that this is already happening. Reports are coming out of the Sunni Arab or Tawafak coalition that they are starting to demand that Iraqi Sunni Arabs get their share of the oil money, and this is good. This implies that Sunni Arabs are starting to accept the architecture of the constitution. They may already be starting to argue within the terms of the constitution, not outside it, and this can only be a positive development. The sooner there is a realistic but also robust, even aggressive Sunni Arab constitutional position, the sooner there will be a decrease in Sunni violence. In brief, the answer is not cabinet posts. It's a set of Sunni strategies that will reassure the people who live in Ramadi and Fallujah that the structure of the new Iraq is not going to change and, if the constitution is properly enforced, does not need to change. Sunni Arabs can have their share of Iraq's wealth, can have a stake in Baghdad politics, and can also, if they want, press for forms of self-government. One of the corollaries of the present situation, then, is that this constitutional review process will not produce many constitutional amendments. There are no prizes for that prediction, since we've already heard from Mr. Hakim and Mr. Talabani. I find it a little surprising, frankly, that people were surprised at these statements, because they have been the clear positions of those two parties for some time. The Shia alliance and the Kurdish coalition did not change the constitution in advance of the October referendum, when they were at least in theory staring down the barrel of a possible Sunni veto of that constitution. Now that the constitution has been approved, where is the incentive for those two parties to dismantle federalism? Where will the pressure come from? Well, the answer is nowhere. Even though there will be, in theory, a four-month period in which the threshold for amendment is lowered to a simple majority in the parliament, there will still need to be a referendum to approve any changes, and a referendum in which the governorate veto remains. However, I should note that Mr. Hakim only ruled out any significant changes. He didn't specifically rule out the raft of non-political, technical improvements that could be made to the draft, and I know that Skiri and other parties have already started looking at those. Even more importantly, though, I would expect that the constitutional review process, even if it doesn't produce many amendments, will start a negotiation that will address the all-important structural issues and on terms which can go a long way to reassuring Sunni Arab Iraqis. These talks, while perhaps not strictly constitutional, could yet be very promising. There was not a popular debate over summer on the structure of Iraq's government. There was no real social contract drawn up, no real contractual relationship with the state created at an individual or even a local level. It could have happened, and in fact the Skiri chairman of the Constitution Committee, Sheikh Umam Hamoudi, wanted it to happen. It didn't. There was not enough time. But these issues must be hammered out now. The review process must identify those tradable items, those exchangeable political commodities that will allow a proper social contract to be put in place. The review process will and should be the forum for agreeing an oil law and revenue sharing apparatus. It should be the forum for deciding on how new federal regions are created, and in my view, agreeing to limits on the size of new federal regions, as was the case in the transitional administrative law. It should be the forum in which the structure and composition of the national and regional legal systems are agreed, and so on. So if we look at these electoral results, we can say that things in Iraq are much worse than one might think, and much better. Much worse in the sense that the Iraq that some hoped for does not exist, a unitary state in which political platform means more than ethnicity or sect. It probably won't exist for a long time, if ever. Iraq is also worse in the sense that these electoral results, even with elected Sunni leadership, and even after, let's say, the formation of a government of national unity, none of this will, in itself, stem the flow of blood in Iraq. The blood is flowing not because of the composition of the Jafari cabinet, but because Sunni Arabs have not come to terms with the new structure of Iraq. However, things are much better than one might think, because it is possible that Sunni Arabs can commit to this constitution. Specifically, it is possible for a family in Fallujah to receive equal protection under this constitution, and it's possible for that realisation, which still has not yet dawned, to produce peace in Iraq. Just to address the final question then, what we as non-Iraqis need to do, I think we need to change the terms of the discussion. For too long, our strategies have been built around an imaginary, unitary Iraq, which does not exist and should no longer be imagined. It is not the end of Iraq, but it must be the end of any effort to rebuild Iraq in the image of Sweden or some other fairy tale democracy. I'm reminded of the passages in Mr. Bremer's book, where he needed to almost bully Iraqi political leaders into joining the governing council, and his subsequent frustration and despair. This is not so different from the experience last summer with the US government pushing the Kurdish and Shia parties into a room on August the 8th and asking them to produce a constitution by August the 15th. What came out was indeed a constitution, but it was not a nationalist document. It was not a social contract. You can apply as much pressure as you like, but the pressure cooker approach cannot cook up an Iraqi identity out of thin air. More modest goals are needed, goals that are specifically designed to prevent violence by accepting Iraq's regionalisation, encouraging cross-regional resource sharing, commerce and credible local government. If we use the coalition forces to protect the marketplace of political trading, as it were, rather than trying to prop up institutions that don't really exist, then we will be out of Iraq sooner rather than later. Peace may be a little easier to find if we address the real problem and not the fanciful one. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You suggest, it's interesting, it's a provocative suggestion, that the Constitution isn't all that bad in the end anyway, and that it can provide the framework for the kind of political deals that are needed in Iraq. The floor is open to comments and questions. We're going to use a microphone so that everybody can hear. I asked that people line up so I have some idea of how many people we've got who want to intervene, and we'll start with you.
Hi, I'm Sam Parker from USIP. I have a question for Dr. El-Moussaoui. It's a two-part question about sort of the internal politics of the UIA. First of all, I'd like to get your take on the competition that's going on within the UIA between the Dawah candidate, Ibrahim Jafari, your candidate, Adel Abdel Mahdi, as well as the Fadila Party candidate, and how you would say that what hangs in the balance, depending on who finally gets chosen or possibly even elected to that position. And second of all, there have been reports that, I mean, from the beginning of the election when the lists were chosen, that the UIA all may not be well within the UIA. There's obviously tension as reflected by this battle for the prime minister position, but also Fadila Party tried to leave the alliance, but for technical reasons couldn't, and they've been threatening to leave again. People know that Sutter is not necessarily happy, the Ras Al-Ayun being a sort of manifestation of that. So what do you foresee as the duration of the alliance its political stability and what the implications could be of a possible disintegration.
Please.
Regarding the PM position in the United Iraqi Alliance, I think they're going to go with the voting inside within the United Iraqi Alliance members. That's which may be 150 to 160 members in the United Iraqi Alliance. And they're going to go with two votes. First vote, they're going to go with the four nominees, which is Adel Abdel Mahdi, Ibrahim Jafari, and Sheikh Shahristani. Just yesterday nominated himself to be the nominee of the independence, and Nadeem Jabri from the Al-Fadila or the Virtue Party. The first term going to be, there is two winners, and the second term will be one winner. We believe that Adel Abdel Mahdi, as the nominee of the Siri, has good opportunities to win this position. The tension among the parties in the United Iraqi Alliance, we believe that this is normal, you call it tension, but I believe it is normal movement inside the United Iraqi Alliance, and everybody knows that. The Sadrists, we worked very hard to bring the Sadrists to the United Iraqi Alliance, and the Sadrists right now, their alignment with the Ja'fari instead of to be with the. We believe that's containing the political parties, especially the Shia parties, and bring them to the one coalition is very important at this time to don't let any party to take the initiative to lead or to do something wrong with the peaceful process in Iraq. And especially, you have actually a bad experience with the Sadrist last year, actually in 2004. This is the main purpose for Siri, especially to bring all parties, Islamic parties, and especially from the Shia side, to the United Iraq Alliance. We believe that's normal movement there, and I don't think it would lead for serious tension between the parties.
You think the alliance will hold together in the parliament?
I believe so. There is a platform, actually. They also they. Just drafted a platform for the United Iraqi Alliance, and there is an agreement from all the parties inside the United Iraqi Alliance.
Please.
Victor Miller, private individual. I just want to say that all the political theory and all the talk about democracy doesn't really address the intense tragedy of the country. I think they've been occupied by foreign power under suspicious circumstances, and they're being devastated by an insurgency that knows no end. When a war like this is being waged, I think you carefully, and I emphasize carefully, examine the motives and goals of both sides. This ultimately is a new form of warfare. I refer to it as non-traditional warfare. It's not like anything we've really ever known. In Africa, in parts of Africa, they're still waging traditional forms of warfare. But the question I still ask, and I presume that from what I'm hearing here today, that the insurgents are the Sunnis, but what do they want? And would American withdrawal let the country collapse into chaos? Or would, perhaps as I believe, let it start the real process of rebuilding a shattered nation? And I stand here in the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I really think that we should carefully examine how we, as Americans, what role we've had in this quagmire. And perhaps we need new solutions. We need different ways of looking at it. Because I'm not sure if this political, the democracy that we're trying to foist on them right now, is necessarily a workable solution given the state of chaos of the country. Thank you.
Question of American withdrawal, would it help?
Well, I can just quickly, people I spoke with in Fallujah on Election Day, even those running for office who were running on a platform of kicking the Americans out as soon as possible, when you talk to them about it a little bit, as soon as possible for them still meant a few years, because they recognize, I think, that the total chaos that would ensue. I mean, this is what they told me, that they thought that, the way one of them phrased it was, well, it was the Americans who destroyed the army and they have to rebuild it, which is essentially the American position as well.
Anna Shalal?
Yeah, I think the other thing that's important is Iraqi society is really broken. I mean, under Saddam Hussein and under that sort of dictatorship, it really created a lot of divisions between people because, as any dictator knows, you divide and conquer. And I think the process of reconciliation is really what's sorely lacking in this whole issue. We're sort of going from sort of a very divided society and sort of forcing it into a situation that's to accept the election, to accept the way things are, and to accept all of these sort of facts on the ground that we put together for them without really putting any building blocks for them to be able to start to trust each other. As you know, during Saddam Hussein, you couldn't trust your brother, you couldn't trust your neighbor. It was always a real problem. How do you expect to go from that into accepting an election? I mean, Iraqis had elections during Saddam Hussein. You know, it's not a matter of that they've seen what's like to go to a voting, a booth and pull the lever. That's not the only thing. So there's a real mistrust in government. And I think for us to sort of force this kind of government on them without building a process of reconciliation, bringing a public process of reconciliation, where you bring the warring factions and the broken factions together at some level on a civil level, then you can build a government that people can trust and move forward on.
Would U.S. withdrawal help that process?
Absolutely. I think the U.S. withdrawal would absolutely help that process. I think the U.S. has been playing the role of a terminator rather than a facilitator, and I think they need to be there to facilitate the dialogue, to facilitate the bringing together the different factions, not to be there as the iron fist as they have been.
Karima Mousali?
I believe all Iraqis would withdraw the American troops or the United coalition troops. But I don't think this time is the proper time for withdrawal of American troops right now. I think the agreements between the Iraqi political parties that they are believe or there is that the Iraqi government should take care of the this job after the they are to make sure that the Iraqi forces could protect the Iraqis and the Iraqi border. Withdrawal, I think it's very negative process right now, and I don't think it will solve the problem in Iraq. We have to make sure that there is a certain group in Iraq. We call them insurgents. They are doing this problems in Iraq. And unfortunately, they hijacked the Islam, and unfortunately, they hacked some group of Sunnis in Iraq. We believe that the coalition troops right now very important to the Iraqis to protect the experience of Iraq, the democratic experience in Iraq right now.
If I could add just one more thing. I think under maybe a different circumstance, you could probably say that, but we've seen there's been so many missteps since the war. I think at the beginning of the war, people did feel that maybe the coalition forces were there to protect them, but since then, from the scandal of Abu Ghraib to the attacks on Fallujah to attacks on cities to the demolition of homes to the indiscriminate air bombing and so on, all that argument that they're there to help us is gone. So I think it's going to be very hard to build upon saying, okay, let's start fresh again. I think people are just sort of tired of seeing the U.S. Army around. I mean, when they see a convoy going by, they don't think, oh, I'm going to be safe now. They think, I'm in danger right now. So they don't see the U.S. military as their protector. They really see it as their detractor.
Jonathan, did you want to comment on this?
I think it's important that we not simply...
Jonathan, into the microphone, please.
Important that we not simply replace in our minds the sort of the idea of the Iraqi who loves America with the idea of the Iraqi who hates America. I mean, that would be too facile. A lot's been made of the resolutions coming out of the Cairo meeting, which included, a resolution sort of supporting the idea of a timetable for withdrawal, but it was hardly an unequivocal and immediate call for coalition withdrawal from Iraq. even within the Sunni community, much less the Iraqi community, where, of course, there is a great deal of support for continued presence. I mean, I think I just agree with Mr. Shalal's comment that though there presumably is a role for coalition presence in Iraq continuing in some capacity, it must be much more in the nature of a facilitating role rather than a directorial role, as it's been too often, I think, in the past. And I mean, this goes to the question of, you know, of the kind of intercommunal exchange. And the question then is, of course, what gets exchanged? It's not just a matter of encouraging Iraqis of different stripes to get in a room and try to reconcile with each other, whatever that means. The question is, what are the, you know, what are the real commodities, political, economic, that get traded? And I think, I mean, one of those is obviously has to be oil, and there are a bunch of others as well. But that's the name of the game. It's creating the conditions, preserving the conditions, securing the conditions for those exchanges to be made. And that may not involve rapid withdrawal, but it would probably involve decreased visibility, decreased presence.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Dave Pollack from the State Department, and I'd like to ask about the social agenda of the new Iraqi government and the extent to which that can actually be implemented. I'm thinking of issues of Islamic law, of women's rights and status and role in the new government and in Iraqi society, of the reality, as we read about it, of gangs, especially in the south, who are enforcing Islamic principles or their idea of Islamic rules by violence, and so on. And so the question is directed, first of all, at Mr. Mousavi on behalf of the leading party in the new parliament, but also to the other panelists, whether you have some ideas about how that issue is likely to evolve in the future Iraq. Thank you.
Dr. Mousavi.
Yes. Regarding the Islamic law, there is an article in the Constitution talking about respecting Islam and respecting the democracy as well. And this is very clear to all. We are in a society that's composed of 97% of the population of the Iraq are Muslims. So we have to put some kind of protection to their beliefs. This is first, and I think this is with an agreement of all Iraqis. So this is in the Constitution. The women's rights, I think we are here in the Constitution also mentioned that the women should have a certain quota in the National Assembly. And they got this quota right now, and I think it's almost 33%. The situation in the South and the Kurdish situation, I think it's... I believe, and most Iraqis believe, there is kind of exaggeration regarding the security situation in the South. We believe that the security in the South is stable, and we can run the southern provinces by the Iraqi forces and by the Iraqi provincial councils, and we believe this is the quietest, after the Kurdish area, of course, and the entire region.
Others? Anas?
In the Constitution, Section 1, Article 2 states specifically that Islamic law supersedes all other laws, and I think for a lot of women that is a there's a fear there, and there's a sense that I know, for example, just speaking to relatives and to friends that are you know living there, they cannot go out of their house without being covered. Now they used to be able to do that. And when they're not covered, they're sort of, you know, sneered at, and when they go to sort of government offices or something like that. So I think there's a sense of regression there in the rights of women, and so I think that's very real what you said.
Jonathan?
If I can be forgiven for just referring to the Constitution again, the areas of law that typically govern these kinds of matters, namely family law and criminal law, this is significant, I think, are not exclusive powers of the federal government. They are areas of law in which regions, there being only one region, of course, at the moment, but we expect more, can assert legislative authority. So I think increasingly the answer to the question, what will Iraqi society look like, will be answered at a regional level, not a not a national one, and even the interpretation of that statement that Dr. Anas mentioned in Section 2 of the Constitution, the statement of the importance of Islamic law, the interpretation of that principle will not be done so much at the national level as at the regional one. And the question, I mean, there is a question, I think, as to whether there is even a right of appeal from, let's say, the senior Kurdistan regional government court to the Supreme Federal Court and so on. So I would not assume that there will be also one answer to that nationally. In fact, I'd presume that it will be many different answers.
Just briefly, with the quota of women in the parliament in the week or two after the election, I went around and tried to talk to as many potential candidates as I could. And I was going to some of my previous usual suspects of women's organizers, people who had lobbied and succeeded in getting this guarantee in the Constitution. I found most of them were pessimistic. They thought that the quota had been previously filled in the parliament by people who were intentionally not going to do much, let's just put it that way. And even Selma Kafaji, who was one of the most prominent popular women, left the Shiite alliance to join a secular party and is probably not going to get a seat. So it'll really be a question of whether you have that quota, will any of those people be technocrats? Will they be people who are there to advance, to protect what they see as rights for women guaranteed in family law?
Thank you.
Next.
Sort of building off that, I wonder if you could talk about where you think family law is going. I was at a meeting yesterday with a number of Iraqi women, and their chief concern was the family law with Article 39 that allows different family laws for different people. They were worried that this would not only deny women's rights, but increase separation between people in Iraq if they're operating under different family laws. I wonder if you could give some idea of where you think that's going.
Please.
The 139 article or law, it means that each Iraqi, and according to his or her belief, going to do his family, following his family law or her family law. In the past, before the 1958, there is a law working on the same direction that's right now stated in the Constitution. This, I think, and most Iraqis believe that this is with the right of the individuals to go through two kind of registrations, the religious and the governmental registrations. So that would give more rights to the people, on the contrary of the what's going on of the propaganda against this law. We believe the women or the man, the marriage or divorce or the heritage, should follow his own beliefs in that. So I think it's more right than abusive the rights of the people.
If I can just further his question, would that mean things like the marriage age, the marriageable age in the southern region? Could it go down much lower than it is now?
Marriage age?
The age of consent for women in marriage, for example. Something that's one hot button issue that comes up. These are the, I guess, metrics that the outside world will look at and say, wow, now it's legal for a 9-year-old woman to get married.
Again, we have to respect the Iraqis' reality, the Iraqis' religion beliefs. This is belong to the Iraqis themselves. And I think there is some example even here in the United States. There is less than 18 years and they go to the government and to the courts and by taking their parents to do their marriage. Here, I know some Iraqis here. So it's belong to the Iraqis themselves. This is part of the freedom that the Iraqis right now have. To the Jewish people or to the Christians, they cannot go to the mosque to do their own. There is nothing from that. But the Shia or the Sunna or other religious groups should go to their own religious authorities to do their own registration regarding these issues, marriage or divorce or something like, or other issues. So I don't think it's against the human rights or but we believe that it's with the right of the people in Iraq.
Eric Gustafson with the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. I have one big question for the full panel, and then I have another second question specifically for Mr. Al-Musawi. The first question in general is, I think there's general agreement that the focus needs to be about creating conditions that allow for a responsible withdrawal of U.S. forces that transfers all authorities to the new Iraqi government, that we leave a stable Iraq behind. The question, though, that I have is, it appears that there are a number of members of Congress that see it as an either-or option. Either you help rebuild Iraq and help stabilize Iraq, or you withdraw. And I just wanted to get comment from the full panel if they see it in the same light, that, you know, we're already seeing funding being cut, funding running out for some of the major organizations, humanitarian agencies, development agencies that are on the ground in Iraq doing work. You know, some of the funding is going to start running out in July. There doesn't appear to be any plans, or there's a question of whether or not there's going to be strong will on the part of Congress to be able to allocate the funds that are necessary. And recognizing how we got to this point, $20 billion allocated to reconstruction in Iraq were, you know, as the reports indicate, a lot being lost to corruption, a lot being diverted to security costs, not seeing tangible results on the ground in Iraq in terms of improvement of basic services. But the question still remains, can the U.S. just simply leave and not continue its commitment to providing the kind of development assistance that seems to be necessary to even allow for a responsible withdrawal of U.S. forces? So that's a question for the full panel. And then a specific question for Mr. Al-Musawi. I hear a lot, you know, we do hear a lot in terms of the, I mean, it's a conflict in Iraq. So the rhetoric is on all sides, can be very violent. But what I'm concerned about is, just as we hear some using the banner of resistance to justify acts that cannot be justified, it also appears that there's the banner of fighting terrorism. And the question is, given that the institutions that are being established are still very weak, what can be done to ensure that the rule of law prevail, even when we're talking about individuals that are part of the government that may be implicated in terrible abuses, as we've heard with the discovery of the prisons and torture?
Yes. So for sure we condemned the torture in the Interior Ministry, and I think it was wrong, and we, as Siri, we blamed the Interior Minister about this kind of actions. Unfortunately, it's this kind of let me say, call it scandals, its effect on the whole image of the Iraqi new process. But also, we have to understand that the, what you call the banner of fighting terrorism, this is a true. There is, we have a terror crisis right now in Iraq, and thousands of Iraqis killing in more than 85,000 during the past 3 years, mostly from the Shia. It is not kind of banner, but it is a real fight against the terrorism in Iraq. We have to take many actions to prevent or to protect the Iraqis' lives. The second question. Regarding the first question, I believe, and we mentioned many times, that we are with withdrawing of the coalition troops, but we believe this is not the proper time for that. We have to setting a kind of timetable for drawing of the coalition troops. It belongs to the elected government, and we believe this is one of the tasks that we should the next government take care of it, and I think we will solve this problem. Right now, we will give really wrong message to the terrorists and to the Osama bin Laden, who threatened yesterday all Iraqis, especially the Shia. And if we give a chance to people like Zarqawi and bin Laden And I think you can imagine what they can do there in Iraq against the Shia first, as infidels and as Iranians, and then against the coalition troops. We believe we have to protect the Iraq experience right now. The democracy is in good progress right now, and we believe the elections and the three elections last year give a great indication that we are in good progress.
I guess the question is whether the choice is a stark choice between withdrawal or staying to finish the job. And I'm worried, talking to troops on the ground, for example, they don't think that it's interesting. I think so far the U.S. has been learning a lot of lessons, starting from a position of where there were huge errors made. We don't need to go over them. My experience embedding with U.S. troops over the last 3 years is that they're getting a lot better on the ground, just with real nuts and bolts stuff. I've been really impressed by how well they're learning from their mistakes. But at the same time, I'm hearing from them that they don't think that the United States has the stomach to stay there for the amount of time to get the job done. And I don't know if I can really disagree with them. It's going to the people who are getting good at what they're doing, getting good at training Iraqi troops, are getting to know how long it's going to take, and they're worried. One thing, I was in I guess a year ago November, before the assault on Fallujah, I was embedded on the way to Fallujah, briefly stayed at Habaniya Air Base, which was a British base until 1958, and the British base had these great brick structures, and they had a swimming pool, and they had a racetrack, and they had a church, and they had a graveyard. And can you imagine an American diplomat or soldier being buried in Iraq? I haven't met anybody over there, and there are some incredibly committed, well-intentioned people working over there, but none of them have that mindset. I'm going to stay here for 10 years, and I'm going to fix this place. So you get a turnover. You meet people who've been in the country for a week, and they're in they have huge responsibilities. It's worse.
I think we've forgotten what the job is. To stay there and finish the job. What does that mean? Are you rooting out terrorism? Are you making Iraq a better society? Are you trying to make it a democratic society? Are you rebuilding schools? Are you rebuilding roads? All of these things have become sort of mired in all kinds of mess. As far as the withdrawal and reconstruction, I see those as being not mutually exclusive. You can withdraw and reconstruct at the same time. I think we should certainly put a lot more effort into reconstruction and reparations than we have, and focus more on that. As far as sort of if the U.S. withdraws, the country will fall into the hands of the Zarqawis and so on. One of the biggest problems and the reason why people like Zarqawi are able to function the way they do is that the borders are so porous, it's ridiculous. In Iraq, I have people telling me all the time that they can go into Iraq, just travel from one end to the other and not be faced with any kind of obstacles or any kind of checkpoints, and yet it's happening all the time. People come in from Jordan, people come in from Syria, people come in from all over the place. If the borders can be sealed at a much higher level than they are now, and at the same time U.S. troops, I'd like to see U.S. troops act as the border patrols for Iraq, so that the Iraqis then can finish the job, because the Iraqis know what the job is.
Next.
First of all, my name is John Powers. I was a captain in the 1st Armored Division in Adamiya, Baghdad. Thank you for putting this on today. As we look at the solutions, talk about capacity building, acceptance, trust and reconciliation, civic engagement, understanding acceptance of the Constitution, and as we address who's governing Iraq next, what is being done to engage the youth and teach them about the Constitution, about democracy, civic engagement? Quill, I'll ask you first, because from the ground level, I know I was back in August, so from the ground level, there isn't much being done to engage the youth. And from a higher level, what is intent to be done? How are we going to teach the youth about what a democracy is so they're not the next insurgents?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Certainly not many of the people I was talking to during in October had read the Constitution, but I don't know if that's unusual in a democracy. I think people will take cue from people they respect. Their leadership will tell them how to vote, and that's not necessarily undemocratic if they respect that person. I wish I could even address your question. I think in the North there's enough security so that you can go to a middle school, and if you speak Kurdish or have a translator, then you can hear opinions about democracy, certainly opinions about federalism and partition from young people. It's been a while since I've had a chance to do that out on the streets in the South. I think, unfortunately, it comes back to security. And in order to have the security to run programs like that, especially that would involve young girls as well as young boys, it's all about security.
Yeah. Actually, I would come with that. The youth minister, I had good talks with him last week, and he mentioned that there is more than 11,000 youth centers in all over Iraq, but
157.
How much?
It's 157.
157. Okay, so this is good. Sorry. Maybe in the South only. So there is good progress there, and they have actually providing these centers in modern computers and some other facilities to improve the situation of the young people there. So I think it's good. So there's many progressive in there.
That's actually my project, the computer project. That's what we're working with the youth centers on.
Wonderful.
But yeah. Before that, there wasn't much in terms at all. This is the first USAID proposal to address youth.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was schools, but nothing to address the youth. So,
well, thank you.
I am talking about the youth, former youth minister, sorry. Oh. Not the current one.
I should perhaps note that successor generations and women have been an important focus of USIP's own grant-making activity in Iraq. It's all very small, but we like to think it's important, and we would like to expand it as well. Dana
Ayer from USIP. In conflict transformation processes, in going from violent conflict to nonviolent political conflict, you tend to have two problems. You've got to arrive at the political deal, and then there's the problem of guaranteeing that the political deal that's arrived at the table can get implemented. And all parties have to have sufficient confidence in that process of implementation that they're willing to reduce violence and stay at the political table. Jonathan has talked a lot, and I think everyone has mentioned that, some process of deal making has to occur. But what about that process of implementation, of guarantee for the political process? Is that something that an intermediary or a third party needs to engage in? Can the U.S. play that role? There are a wide range of implementing that kind of guaranteeing role, and everything from good offices to peacekeeping trips. But what I'd like to hear the panel think about a little bit is what is that next step? How do we ensure that everyone has the confidence that the deals that get done actually will get implemented?
Please.
I would like to mention to the relation between the American Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and the Iraqis, Iraqi political parties. And we believe that the Iraqis, this is the view of the Iraqis, the political party leaders. They believe that this is a wonderful relation, and as Siri mentioned from the beginning of the Iraqi liberation, that the Americans are our partners. And we believe in this partnership and to work together. Yes, the Americans did many mistakes during the Bremer time and right now as well, especially in the security files or security cases. The guaranteeing of the deals in the political process is very important, and I think, and this is during the Iraqi opposition age, the many of the Iraqi political parties believe in the third partners. And I believe the Americans could play this role as a third partner, and through that should be very impartial through all Iraqi parties. We are we have some accusations, actually, some actions that the Americans did in the past, and we believe shouldn't do. For example, the calling for the participation of the Sunnis. The participation of the Sunnis could restore the stability in Iraq. We are totally against this kind of slogans or this kind of message. We believe that the Iraqis should work all together to create their own stability and to protect their country. Mentioning to any sect or party in Iraq would give wrong message as well to the Iraqis themselves. We are working with the Americans together as the Americans as our partners in terms of working with the all Iraqis, not with certain sects. Don't defend any sects on our party, but we should work for all Iraqis. And I think with this aspect, I think we will succeed all together, the Americans and Iraqis, to establish a good democratic experience in Iraq.
Jonathan?
Just on the question of sort of third-party guarantees, I mean, I think there's definitely a role for the IMF and the World Bank to, in a sense, guarantee the credibility of Iraq's oil revenue sharing. I mean, they've played this role in other countries as well, in perhaps less difficult circumstances. Interesting observation I made while I was watching the constitutional negotiations play themselves out in summer is that up until a relatively late stage in those negotiations, it was part of the Kurdish position, a position advanced by Dr. Saad Barzanji of the Kurdish delegation to the Constitutional Committee, that the constitution of Iraq itself should be guaranteed internationally. I think his proposal was that the UN would, in a sense, be a party to the constitution. That provision was removed late in the day, but it's interesting to see that there was at least some willingness to contemplate that possibility. Of course, the American government played a role in a sense, guaranteeing the peace deal between the two Kurdish administrations in the late 90s. I mean, there is a history of international guarantees of peace in Iraq, and that may well be an attractive option, although I think the best incentive for there to be a peaceful deal done is for each of the parties to have an incentive, an indigenous local incentive to see that the deal done, not to be relying on a third party.
I think the international part is very important and essential. I think Americans as partners, I'm not sure. I think for Iraqis, the Americans are also partners with Saddam Hussein. I mean, let's not forget that. And I don't think the Iraqis have forgotten that. I think right now the Shia are just in a convenient coalition with the Americans because it's the only way that they could see power. I don't see the trust, being there to be able to move anywhere just past this initial stage. So the Americans being partners, I don't see it as being a realistic option for moving forward.
Whom would you want as an international guarantor?
I think maybe more of the Arab countries to be more involved. Certainly the United Nations, I think, has some credibility still and can get involved. But the fact that a lot of the parties are working with Khalilzad and to me, I think, and to many Iraqis, I would assume, sort of rings very hollow, and they see it as being just a marriage of convenience at this moment, but can turn at any time.
Excuse me.
Please.
I think the Iraqis had very bad experience with the United Nations in the past, during Saddam age and during the United Nation. The Akhtar al-Brahimi envoy. And also, we have bad experience with some Arabs. So we cannot get a partnership from the United Nations because most Iraqis do not accept this kind of partnership. With the Arab countries, I just would ask, from where the terrorists coming to the Iraq, mostly? Yes, we cannot prevent Iranians from interfering from Iraq. but most of the terrorists coming from the Arab countries. And we believe that the Arab rules right now, we are seeking for good and peaceful relations with the Arab countries. This is our fate in Iraq. We have to do that. But the Arabs also, they do not understand this reality in Iraq right now also. We are not as a Shia seeking for power, but we have to ask ourselves first, what Saddam did to the Shia and to the Kurds? They are Iraqis or not? Just a simple question. We believe that the Iraqis can do their own job, and I think with the partners, with the partnership with the Americans, I think for certain time, and we for sure the Shia and the Kurds and the Sunnis, most of the Sunnis right now getting involved in the political process, and this is acceptance, and they are believing in the same partner, the Americans. So I think most of Iraqis believe that the Americans real partner there right now, and the United Nations and the Arab countries, I don't think they are they could carry this kind of job right now with the Iraqis.
Well, the Shia, I remember that under Saddam Hussein was when the worst atrocities were happening, that the U.S. was in concert with him and supporting him. I don't know if they would remember that. I think that's an important memory piece that needs to be kept alive. You know, the fact that the Zarqawi is from Jordan does not make all Jordanians terrorists. I'm sorry.
The Shia was, the Shia was the second level of the sixth class.
I understand. Well, he was pretty much an equal opportunity dictator.
This is a discussion that could go on for a long time.
It's a much needed one.
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt though, and I'm going to cut off the questions, Larry. Sorry about that. And just go through the panel and give each of you in reverse order a chance to add anything you'd like to add or sum up as you would like. Jonathan?
Well, maybe I can just sum up by way of answering a question that I didn't answer before about the option, the stark choice between staying the course and cutting and running. I mean, the answer has to lie somewhere between those two extremes. It is ridiculous that the choice has been posed in those terms to Americans, to the international community in general. Yes, the question is, what is the job? If it is unclear that the job is capable of being done, then what should the job be? How should we define the job? I mean, my humble suggestion is that the job is not, you know, standing up, this phrase that's always used, standing up Iraqi institutions, building things. I mean, it's not, you know, the real gains are to be made at a political level, facilitating rather than directing, rather than constructing. It's got to be a much more subtle approach.
Quill?
I guess just seeing the exchange we just saw, you get an idea. I think sometimes we over here in the United States, one of the great things about Americans is that we don't study history and forget the past almost immediately. And that allows us to see optimistic solutions which might work. But we have to remember that in Iraq, there are still some high passions. Even now, God, 3 years later, people still remember the 80s. there's some passions being played out, and some of this is being played out in revenge and vengeance. I mean, there's some of that still going on, and I mean, reconciliation is going to have to be part of a solution. But more important than that is security in Iraq and having some sort of space where people can start to think about that. And it's interesting, one of the things that I didn't get to say, I had been, some friends of mine in the Kurdish north and some people in Baghdad had suggested to me that the solution to get Baghdad under control was to unleash the Badr Brigade and let them do it. And we've even seen some coded messages coming saying things like, just recently with one of the suicide bombings, people saying, you have to let us do this, let us take care of this. And I think most Iraqis I've spoken with in Baghdad are interested in some serious law and order. But if it's done in a way that inflames the sectarian tensions, which is the way it's been happening so far, where you get the iron fist without any of the benefits, being like being able to walk on the street, well, being able to do business, not fearing kidnapping, then it doesn't, you know, it's obviously not an advantage to be having it that way. So I guess, just want to stress that someone has to take the security situation in hand in order for any of the progress to happen.
And if Shalal?
I would agree, hear that over and over again, that really what Iraqis want is electricity right now. They're really, the elections are sort of a luxury that they have to deal with, but right now they need the basics. But I think the more important dialogue that really needs to take place is really among the Sunnis and the Shia. I think that's a dialogue that's been swept under the carpet and nobody wants to really address it head on. I think it needs to be addressed head on, not only in Iraq itself, but here in this country where Sunni and Shia are living together. And I think we as a diaspora are able to help be the bridge to be able to bring the U.S. and really have the U.S. play the role that it needs to play. So I think oftentimes we tend to speak past each other and above and below each other, and we don't really connect, unfortunately. That's something that I think for Iraq to move beyond this sort of possible civil strife that's going to take place and is taking place right now, I think that's a key element. And I would like to offer the challenge to Dr. Moussaoui to continue the dialogue among Sunnis and among Shia. And by the way, my wife is Shia, and I'm Sunni, just so you know.
I know his family very well. So don't tell me about
it. Yeah, okay.
I just want to make sure.
So we can get along very well.
I just want to make sure that Iraq won't govern only by its three main components. And this is the reality there in Iraq. The Shia cannot run the country by themselves. And the Kurds all together, they should run the country. Also, I would like to assure my brother Anas that most of my friends, they are Sunnis, and I am very close to the Sunnis more even than Shia. And I am the person that I told the chairman of the Constitutional Committee, if you could throw half of the constitution in the Tigris River to convince the Sunni, I think you will do a great job, better than you got 140 articles in the constitution. I am very concerned about our brother Sunnis, and I am just concerned about that the terrorists could hijack the Sunnis and let them being just opposition for the future. Iraq will not govern only by the three main components.
Thank you very much. I think this has been quite a deep discussion of the issues, and I thank the panel for it. Let me say that we should clear this room quickly because another group needs it.
Let me arrange it. I invite you to the council. Okay. Next week.